All right, so tonight we're going to talk about tranquility or calmness. This is the next factor in the seven factors of enlightenment as we go through this exploration this year. I want to pause for a moment and kind of look at the big picture of how the seven factors and the hindrances really are work together. They counterbalance each other. Look at those relationships. And we can step back and look at the hindrances as this movement, the first two actually, are this movement into the future. Okay, so the present moment has its certain qualities of pleasantness or unpleasantness. If it's unpleasant, we tend to move toward what's away from that, into the future. If I get away from that, I'll be happy. If it's pleasant, I want to go into the future, allow that to continue. So this is a movement of craving and aversion. Now, the seven factors counterbalance this with mindfulness, investigation, and wise effort. This turning toward the nature of this moment's experience with a quality of balance of attention, with an investigative quality, and also with a quality of discernment through effort. And then we can also look at the hindrances as this balancing of energy, that when we get overly tired, our minds are dull, heavy, there's a sloth and torpor going through our system. Other times we have this energy of excess, that our minds are racing with worry and anxious thoughts. Our body can't sit still. In this case, there's too much energy. Again, the factors of awakening come in to balance that. Balance it with joy and also with calmness, particularly. So this calmness, this sense of tranquility, is also a good balance for joy, the previous factor. Because if we get so much joy, we start to, it can almost be this intensity of energy. And learning to have this calm factor come in to balance that, it's like adjusting our carburetor. You want the right amount of air and fuel to let the engine run very smoothly, very well. So you can see how these factors of awakening and hindrances really work well together, both as countermeasures, counterbalancing, and also balancing with each other. Now, this factor of tranquility and calm can have a shadow side in our practice, along with joy, along with equanimity. And this is when we take the idea of that state, you know, what does calm look like? You know, what does tranquility look like? What does joy look like? You know, what does equanimity look like? And we take those states and we have this idea of how that should be and how I shall look within that state. So then I start to try to act that way. I try to be a calm person, even though internally I'm anything but calm. I try to find a sense of joy, even though I may have a deep amount of grief. Equanimity, try to be this kind of aloofness instead of the true equanimity of being equally close to all things. So when we create an image of what it means to be spiritual and what it means to be a joyful person who's spiritual, to be a calm person, to be a person with equanimity, it sets up this denial of how this moment actually might be, how we actually might be in our true experience. And of course, it feels better to be calm than agitated. It feels better to feel that sense of ease that comes from that tranquility. But the shadow side is when we start to deny what's really happening. And really, the test comes when the change of conditions happens. We can feel a sense of calmness and tranquility and kind of faking that if things are going pretty well in our life. The true test is when things aren't going so well, where is that calmness? Where is the access to that? And that really points to, where is that coming from? Is a calmness coming from something self-induced, or is it coming from an inner transformation? There's a famous sutta called the Simile of the Saw, that in one part of the sutta, the Buddha is using this example of this mistress who had a servant. And the mistress was very calm and collected and very peaceful, kind. But the servant kind of wondered, you know, is she really that way, or is she just kind of putting on a show? So for some reason, the servant decided to test her by showing up late to work and not doing so good at her job. And sure enough, the mistress was calm and collected when things were going the way she wanted. When they weren't, then she got more and more agitated to the point of physical violence toward the servant, who kept kind of, you know, upping the ante with this to test her mistress. So the Buddha pointed to this as we don't want to take on this idea of being calm, of being tranquil, without the inner transformation. This is the shadow that we have to always be attending to. It's not about looking the part, especially when we tie it up into this self-image of being calm, of being, you know, being like the Buddha. You know, all the statues show the Buddha being very in repose. It's not about this external appearance. It's really about this internal transformation. What transforms in us so that calmness becomes this more natural state? So that being said, you know, talking about the shadow side and also the relationship between calm and the seven factors, calm and the hindrances, let's look at some of the three sources of tranquility. These aren't the only sources, but will be ones we can explore tonight. So first one is around our wise intention and our wise action. You know, how our intention of non-harm, of kindness, generosity, and the actions that support that are a source of tranquility, a source of calmness. The second one is working with our impulses and reactivity, this tendency to be so reactive in our lives, and learning how to meet that through the skills of mindfulness, of investigation, of steadiness, of attention, and how that in itself transforms those into calmness. And finally, the tranquility that comes from insight. How that deep transformation changes that very relationship to life. So first, looking at the wise intention, the wise action. These tend to calm our minds, calm our hearts, because we're acting and intending from a certain way. Conversely, when we're acting in a way that's harmful, we create these waves of agitation in our minds, in our hearts. You know, we're worried about being found out, about covering up. You know, what lie did I tell last time? I have to make sure that lie I'm telling now supports that. So it creates more noise in our system. Maybe it moves us further away from the state of tranquility. So non-ill will is one of the primary intentions, this non-will and ill-will, not wishing harm, not wishing hatred. And reflecting that when you get caught up in that ill-will, when you really are hating someone or just really disliking someone, you know, think about anybody in your workplace or your family or perhaps the larger political realm. And how that creates a level of agitation in your system. The more you reflect on how much you dislike that particular person or situation, does that calm your heart? Does it calm your mind? Or does it lead to a different direction of more agitation? Through the practice, of course, we want to acknowledge what's present, you know, what is being triggered by this particular relationship or attitude with this person. But seeing is very different than adding to. It's like the old-time locomotives that were steam-driven, that they would pour coal in the fire, and the more coal they put in the fire, the hotter it would burn, the hotter the steam, the faster it would go. So when we have that, we're really cultivating this quality of ill will. We're putting lots of coal in that fire. We're going faster and faster down those tracks, further and further from calm, from clarity. And so learning how to just stop shoveling. You know, of course things will arise. It's not about denying what will arise in your mind and heart in responses to other people, other people's actions. But how do we meet that is so critical. We can meet it in a way that increases it, that cultivates that ill will. Or we can meet it in a way with compassion, recognizing the pain that is there in your own heart. Perhaps the pain that other person is experiencing. And then calm starts to arise from this inner transformation of our relationship to this moment's experience. Another intention is that of non-harm, of this is where the wise action from the Eightfold Path come in, the precepts. Because if we are harming, if we're killing other beings, we're stealing, lying, harming through our sexuality, if we're drunk or stoned, there's a level of noise that we cultivate through those actions. There's a level of turmoil, of unrest that we carry. We're churning up our inner life, like taking a cup full of mud and shaking it so it's all suspended. And then we calm down. We stop acting in that way. We start to act in a way that's based in calm, in kindness and in non-harm. That mud starts to settle. And in that settling, calmness arises naturally. And then finally, renunciation is the third intention. And this is simply living life in a more simple way. You know, how do we make choices based on what we really need, what really nourishes us, versus the story that our society and our economy tells us, that the lack that you feel will be solved by this product, by this experience, by this object. And this is something that we're bombarded with again and again. And we're, you know, we have our areas that we really get interested in, and that helps keep our economy going, of course. But it also keeps us churned up. It keeps us full of noise, further and further from stillness, from this tranquility. So this first area of learning how to live in a way that's based in non-harm, really looking at our intentions of non-harm, of non-ill will, of renunciation, starts to bring that quality of calmness, because we're not adding more agitation. And this is part of this is also how we use our sense doors. You know, if you go online, you can find many things to become very upset about very quickly. So there's a balance between and ignoring all the hardships and the horrors in life, and, you know, really being a conscious participant and realizing, how can I be informed enough to make good choices to help ease the harm in the world? And there's another edge when we become more obsessed and our minds become more agitated. In the beginning class, we often give this homework that you take a news fast. That for 2 days, you just renounce looking at any news, you know, any social media, and see how the effect of that is on your mind. How there's a sense of quiet that may happen after you get over the withdrawals. So the second way that cultivates this quality of calmness is, how do we work with our impulses and our reactivity? This is similar to shoveling that coal on that fire, that steam-driven engine. And this is counterintuitive, because there's this, we all experience this level of agitation and unrest, reactivity. And this asks us to actually turn toward that, instead of trying to get rid of it, but actually turn toward it, to actually realize that through this, through the samsara, through the suffering, through the difficulty, is the path to nibbana, is the path to release, to finding calm. Now, it's important to realize that going into the midst of a reactive pattern and really bringing investigation, mindfulness, it may not suddenly work, that suddenly you feel calm. You may feel actually worse, because instead of denying it, being distracted by it, you're feeling it in a more pure, direct way. And in that pure, direct way, there's an intensity to it. But by seeing it with a level of balance of mind and of heart, it starts to disengage in a profound way. So the calmness may reveal itself at a later time. It starts to incline us toward calmness. So I talked about this in the investigation month, that one way we can use investigation is to notice that impulse, the impulse to move, to think, to act, and to pause, to say, is this leading toward suffering or toward freedom? And if it's toward freedom and has no harm, then of course follow that. But if it's some of these habitual things that create us, tying us again and again to suffering, learning to pause with that can be so essential, slowing down. Like when Narayan and I teach at Cloud Mountain, we like to use this bell practice that when the temple bell is rung to bring us back from walking period, to actually let the bell be a call to pause, to stop. And to, you know, and we're all moving very slowly, so it's interesting how the pause even slows us down even more, to interrupt where the mind might be thinking, the distractive thought, to fully call yourself back into this moment. Because there's a tremendous momentum to be reactive. It's like driving a car on an icy road and you try to stop and the ice just keeps you sliding the way you've been going. It's hard to steer, it's hard to change that direction. So that momentum, we have to develop this capacity to feel that skid, to follow that skid. So, okay, I'm not going to go that direction, but still the momentum carries me that way a little bit. But if not adding to it, it starts to disengage in a very significant way. This quote's often attributed to Viktor Frankl, that between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So that stimulus and the response. And so often those are so immediate. There's a stimulus and we react. We do something, get rid of, add more to, chase after, push away, fill in the blank, right? But that pause, that space, allows us to become responsive, to actually choose that. And in that pause, in that space, that's where we pour mindfulness and we pour wisdom, we pour compassion, and seeing what is the wisest thing to do here. And how, learning to call that forth in the midst of our fires, in the midst of the heat of our life's conflicts. And there's different ways to do this. One way is just to go straight into it. So I can go right into the middle of the heart of that conflict, that reactivity. Right? That's one way to work with it. This is feeling the impulse to move, to act. And then feeling, then pausing, feeling the echoes in the body that become highlighted as we don't act from it. The physical, mental, emotional. Feeling it in a very somatic-based way. Feeling those deeper beliefs, the sense of lack, the sense of hunger, the sense of unlivability that may be driving that deeper impulse. Another way to say this is to meet the hindrances, to actually turn toward them, to befriend them. I think in science, there's this term called ohms that's talking about the resistance. So not the ohms that our yoga people do, but the ohms, which is the measurement of the resistance, of how hard is it for electrons to go through an object, through a piece of metal or something. The higher the resistance, the more friction there is, the harder it is. The less friction, the more easily it flows through. And when an object or piece of metal has a lot of resistance, it starts to heat up with that experience. So when we're going directly into the midst of our resistance, we're learning how to have this quality of non-resistance to that experience, allowing it to flow through us. The more resistance we have, the more we heat up, the more hindrance starts to kick up, the quality of restlessness, aversion. The less resistance we have, the more that experience can flow through us. And the calmness arises from that. I like to give the analogy in instructions of being like a permeable membrane, that experience arises and you fully receive it through your front, as we're so oriented because of our eyes, but allowing it to flow behind you, flow it right through. So it passes right through you like a permeable membrane without resistance. It's different than feeling it and resisting it, pushing it away. And it's also different than feeling it and assimilating it, taking it in and holding it tight, which leads to burnout, to overwhelm. So this straight on is, it takes a certain perseverance, a certain bit of grit, tenacity. I remember working with this on a retreat at Cloud Mountain as a yogi and having mosquitoes follow me around. And so, okay, I'm going to take this precept of non-harm really seriously and not swat at them. Okay, so, but what else do I do? I guess I just let them buzz. I didn't quite think that all the way through. So I was doing the walking meditation with a cloud of mosquitoes following me. Right? And for, you know, I've always been very susceptible to bites, so that high-pitched whine had a very strong association, you know, of fear, of reactivity, like it's sound and reaction, no space between stimulus and response. But by practicing with this, for, you know, for 7 days, I would feel the impulse arise to swat. I would feel the visceral dis-ease, discomfort, the emotional dis-ease, just the agitation. And I would invite calmness. Okay, let's just work with this. Let's be as relaxed as we can with this experience. And by doing this over the 7 days, you know, walking many times in the day, by the end I was surprised to hear the sound and have it be free of the reaction. And something happened. I didn't intend that for it to happen, but somehow that got uncoupled, unhooked. And this is the power of really going in the midst of this. That's why we say when you practice, you know, sit still. You know, not to move with every, you know, impulse to scratch an itch or to adjust something. That's training us how to meet that level of difficulty with something that's calm, that's not moving. That teaches us how to meet something that we don't have any choice over. We can always scratch an itch, yes. But can we scratch the itch of a heartache, of a breakup of a relationship, of the ending of a life? Can we meet that? And we learn to do that in this very somatic-based laboratory of our bodies. So this direct path is meeting what's uncalm, what's agitated, with a quality of calmness. And that starts to teach us a very profound way of relating. This, we start to learn that the stillness is underlying all the reactivity. It's actually possible to access that in more and more intense ways, to conditions. Another way to work with this, you know, that direct way, sometimes it's too hot, it's too charged. And often it's we need to look at our balance of attention. What I mean by this is, I've talked about this a number of times this year probably, is that there's a tendency for our attention, the way what we focus on, to have a magnetic attraction to the worst thing possible. Right? You know, you can get 100 evaluations and one is negative, everyone else is, you know, saying you're great, you're going to focus on that one. Right? We all know this. We tend to focus on that one bit of criticism. We tend to highlight whatever in the environment is the most broken, the most wrong, the most scary. And that becomes our point of focus. So it's this magnetic attraction that we have, that actually at that point we're no longer being mindful. We're actually being caught in obsession. Our mind is actually becoming contracted around that state. So in those times, this can happen up with anything, but also particularly when we've had a history of trauma, history of difficulty that's been overwhelming for our nervous system. You know, our nervous system can go down that line. So it's very helpful to learn to balance our attention, to realize in the midst of something that's painful, difficult, there's also things that aren't. There's things of beauty, like these flowers. There's things which are perhaps neutral, like the touch of the air on your skin. There's the contact of your feet on the ground. And learning to have your attention balanced between what is wrong in the moment and also what is right restores that quality of mindfulness, that quality of balance of attention. In that balance, calmness arises. You come back into that which is seen from calmness, from stillness. And this third element here, as we go into working with the resistance, working with the reactivity, is one of metta and of compassion. And sometimes we forget that the simplest way is just to turn towards something with our heart, with this undefended way. And this intention of connection, of well-wishing, of this, or at least the willingness to sit next to, instead of pushing away, can allow us to access that calmness. Because sometimes things are too hot, too intense for any of these skillful means, any of these insight practices. I learned this once when my wife was in the hospital with a very acute illness. And it was one of those things you weren't sure, which way is it going to go? Is this going to be, I'm going to be like a single father with my young daughter, or is my wife going to recover? And there was tremendous anxiety and worry in the midst of that, lots of unknownness. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be a good meditator. I'm going to try to meditate with this. And I was surprised to find that my breath or my body, that tension had no access to those places of refuge. It was like dropping water on a hot skillet. It would just sputter right off. And then I thought, Sharon's often talking about metta, so maybe it's a time to try metta. And so it's like, okay, may you be safe. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. And those phrases and the intention behind that, I directed it to my wife who was suffering, toward myself, toward all the caregivers, all the doctors and nurses. And it was shocking, to be honest, that it allowed myself to connect with the moment in a way that I hadn't thought possible. So reactivity, sometimes we can go directly into it. Sometimes we need to balance our attention. Sometimes we need to cultivate a quality of metta. And often we need to do all three. There has to be this broader approach. Because some of our areas of reactivity show our deepest areas of suffering and our deepest areas of identification. Now the third way that I'm going to talk about tranquility and how that cultivates tonight is through tranquility from insight. Tranquility from insight. I mean, we call this insight meditation for a reason. This is when there's many aspects of insights, many different levels of it, and areas that we have insight into. But generally, it's seeing the source of our suffering so completely, it falls away of its own accord. Okay, it's like a direct seeing. I mean, so much of our training in meditation is learning to see directly, to see clearly, to learn to free up the distortions that we apply, that we paint the world through our prejudice, through our assumptions, to actually see life in a very direct, immediate way. So it can be like just touching a hot stone and actually feeling how much it hurts to touch that stone. And we don't want to pick it up again. And those insights, it can be surprising that when you really see, it's like you're seeing much more completely around a pattern, a stance, a deeply held belief that you've held for most of your life. And you've held it as true. And an insight allows us to see all the way around it, to see it is just a thought, just a belief. And in that seeing, you realize this thing really causes a lot of suffering. This causes tremendous harm in my life and in others. And why do I keep picking it up? It's because I haven't seen the fullness of it. And the moment of seeing the fullness, then it's like feeling, you actually feel the burn. And no longer there's the impulse to pick it up. Actually, it lets go of us. And this is part of this kind of mysterious aspect of insights. And it's outside of our timeline. We can't force the insight. We can't say, okay, during this sitting, this retreat, this year, I'm going to have X number of insights. Right? I mean, some of you have tried that, I think. But it's like becomes further and further from you the more you grasp after it. And all we do is just meet the moment as fully as we can, with as much sincerity as we can. And insights arise as they will, of their own timeline, their own expression. Part of the trick is that these things are often really on the edge of what is of our ignorance, of our delusion. There's so much of it that's not seen, particularly the parts of how it serves us and how it really benefits us. We just see the part we want to get rid of, but we don't see the part that really benefits us, that served us maybe as young children, for example. That's why I often advise turning towards a pattern like this with a quality of bowing toward it with gratitude, with appreciation, as opposed to that attitude, I'm seeing you in order to get rid of. Okay, that just tightens up the whole unconscious quality. So insights start to transform this underlying premise, this underlying theorem that we've based our life on, the premises that generate suffering. This is the generator of noise. This is what keeps us away from calmness. And they arise again outside of our control. We don't have to rush the process. There has to be a sincerity, a willingness to keep engaging, but not that urgency or that agenda that I have to get this done in this time frame because so-and-so is having much more insights than I am, and all those things. Sometimes we may not even realize what is falling away until we start to act and see, well, I'm just completely acting in a different way. There's no longer this impulse to act in the way that I used to act. We're naturally responding in a different way. Things that used to trigger us don't. Things that used to generate noise and conflict and agitation no longer do. We start to find our minds have a quieter set point. There's not as much noise going on. Perhaps that falls away completely. Often the insights fall along the three characteristics, could be a way to kind of group them in a general way. And always insights have a quality of letting us fall into stillness. We have an insight, there's this quality of stillness that just starts to rush up through our system, through our minds, through our hearts. We fall into this level of stillness. And that's how we can distinguish between like a mental fascination or something. Oh, I want to really think more about that. An insight has this quality of making you quiet, quieter in the moment. So the three characteristic dukkha. We start to meet the suffering of this moment with less resistance, with less argument. There's just this natural way of allowing it to be felt, to be met. We don't add the second dart in the same way. Again, that's the level of a reactivity that we add to the unnegotiable pain of physical pain, of loss. It's that added on that we start to release that. Sometimes you notice this quality of vedana, this feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant, starts to transform. There's actually more and more things which are neutral in our experience. So we start to practice and we realize, well, I'm just like, I remember doing these exercises through the DPP program and, you know, out loud saying whatever vedana came through, unpleasant, pleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. And just this constant litany. As the practice deepened, there's much more neutral that starts to arise. We start to perceive life in a way that is not based on our past reactivity. The essence of calm starts to rise. Characteristic of impermanence. We start to deeply understand that all life is in a process of arising and fading, in flux, in flow. And then there's an ease that starts to come to our systems, into our minds, into our hearts. as we're relating to life in this quality of change, realizing that we're not outside of that. That this mind, this sense of me, is also arising and falling. And this alignment with how things are, calm naturally arises from that. And then finally, non-self, anatta. Sometimes we just notice that there's something absent, something that I used to kind of always rely on, that I used to base all my actions from. I can't find that. It's like there's something that's missing. And I realize there's that sense of me is not central. It's not the central sense of my life. And then the reactivity that's so dependent upon that sense of self falls away. Who is there being reactive? That question itself, you see the humor of that. The personalization that we so much get caught in doesn't make sense. This is the deep level of calm that naturally we abide with. The seven factors of awakening. So just to summarize, that tranquility has a quality of balancing joy. You know, if we just had joy without this counterbalance of calm, we would start to have too much energy, become too intense, especially the pitta, the energetic quality of joy. So calmness, tranquility brings this balance. Same thing, if we had too much tranquility without joy, we'd become too dull. Tranquility also is a nice countermeasure to restlessness and worry. That's why the hindrances and seven factors are paired in the seven and then four noble or the four factors of awakening or four foundations of mindfulness. I'll get one of the fours right there. You know, remembering the shadow side of all these states, the idea of being a spiritual person versus the transformation of it. We always have to remember we are humans that may have spiritual experiences, spiritual insight, but there's still the human nature of who we are. That we have to always be aware of that and not deny that humanness. Denying that humanness creates this potential for shadow. This is so much of the root of misconduct we see in spiritual teachers of abusing their power, you know, sexual abuse that comes from that place of denying that humanness. Not only the teacher, but also the community. They hold the teacher up as being somehow not subject to these foibles, to these limitations that we all have as human beings. And calmness can be, you know, we look at those statues. I mean, how many of you looked around in a meditation hall and seen everyone sitting really still and calmly, and you judge yourself for not feeling that? It's like that projection outward, that everyone else is sitting so still, but my internal mind is so active. And finally, these three sources of calm, of aligning our intention and our action, based in non-harm and goodwill. And how that creates this level of stillness that our actions support, and we can feel that sense. Like, you know, I've lived a good life. I lived as kindly as I could today. I acted as kindly, as wisely as I could. As you reflect on that, there's a calmness that arises. Working with our reactivity. You know, there's places when we get caught, learning to actually use that as an entry point into Dharma in our daily life. And finally, insight. You know, to just recognize that insights, as they arise, they change our set point of calmness. This is the seven factors of awakening. So these factors arise in us to allow awakening to arise also. And as the heart releases into stillness, the calmness becomes a natural state, not something that's induced or practiced, but simply our birthright. All right, thank you for your kind attention. If we could just sit quietly for a few moments. to just say a few words about the practice and reflection sheet, the homework sheet. So basically, I went through in this homework the points of this talk, you know, starting by reflection about, you know, how is calmness, how does tranquility show up in your life and in your practice? You know, is there a lot of access to it? Is there a bias toward it? Is there something that you don't have much of in your life? And just to notice that, to notice maybe the causes and conditions that may contribute to that. And how does noticing how does calmness and tranquility balance joy? How that those seem to have that balance of each other, and how it can balance restlessness and worry. Is there a shadow that if we deny our agitation in order to appear calm? You know, notice this, you know, particularly very honestly. You know, when you kind of put yourself, okay, I'm going to be calm even though I'm not feeling calm. How can I really embrace the quality of humanness? How do our actions affect the level of tranquility? And how does working with reactivity affect calmness? And finally, do insights generate tranquility? Just to reflect on that, to see which one of these questions or all of them land in your experience. And next week we'll have a chance to have some small groups and some really voicing what you understand in your own practice and witnessing and hearing your fellow Sangha members and their own exploration. So we have some time for any dialogue around this topic or around your practice, questions or comments. Yes.
How do you, when you were talking about the example of walking around in your walking meditation and the swarms of mosquitoes following you?
Yes.
At what point does that, you know, there are times, like the example that came to mind was someone is allergic to bees, deathly allergic to bees,
right.
A bee is coming by.
Right.
So how do you, for yourself, distinguish those two when it's a true threat and you should listen to that signal that it triggers? Versus times, or is there no distinction?
I think it's a good question. So, just to paraphrase for the recording and those who didn't hear, is there a difference between, like, when the example of walking with the mosquitoes, that sense of discernment is like, when is it, you know, healthy and helpful to do that versus being harmful to yourself? Like, you wouldn't want to do it with a swarm of bees. And that if you're allergic to bees, for example. And it's a really important question. And like in that example, I mean, I tend to like to kind of give structure to my investigation. So like if I had a particular pattern that I was struggling a lot with, I say, okay, I might create a little format or kind of container to hold that. But in that midst of setting that up, I'm also using a lot of discernment here. Okay, am I going to cause any harm to myself or anyone else? You know, how am I going to know when that's too much? All those things. And sometimes you learn that through trial and error. You know, when are you overdoing it? Like sitting still in a meditation. You know, I would start, you know, for the first, you know, 5 years or so, I would sit really still and not move, even though my body was screaming with pain. And I started to notice that scream translated into fear about the next meditation. And I realized, okay, I'm not conditioning my mind the way I want to be going here. So I started to be much more gentle with the body, caring for the body. You know, so that's one of the things that you learn through discernment. And also part of it, though, is that the reactivity, the level of reactivity we have, we often are more reactive than we need to be. And we have to kind of challenge ourselves, again, looking at the container, using discernment, to start to clean that up, to see, okay, this is something I'm really adding to this. This is a level of reactivity that's unnecessary. And I start to get kind of a sense of how my mind does it, how my heart does it. Then other areas I can start to have that discernment a little quicker. But sometimes you kind of have to kind of muddle your way through it. But yeah, always, you know, there's certainly extremes. Like, I don't want to, even if you're not allergic to wasps, you don't want to get stung there. But I mean, when I was a kid, there was some summer camp we did, and it was the people had bees, and I was helping something, and a bee landed on my chin. And the guy said, okay, don't move. So I didn't move, and you know, I was like freaking out, but I was, you know, letting that bee move. And that taught me something. I didn't get stung, it flew away. And so you can kind of play with that. And sometimes something that feels really like it's really vital when you do something, you can actually see, you know, step back and say, okay, what's the worst that's gonna happen here? Yeah, and if it's dangerous, then of course don't do that. But play with the edge, play with it. There's so many life experiences that you can do that. As simple as, you know, you're waiting in the grocery line, and you look over there, you know, aisle three, and they're going much faster. And you're looking at your checkout person, they're like, you know, going slow motion. Mm-hmm. You know, usually what we do is, you know, get mad at this person or go that way. What if you just sat there and say, okay, let me feel this. I'm going to be 5-10 minutes later. What's the difference? But learning to feel that, you actually can learn quite a bit. Mm. Yeah, so play with it in really safe, easy ways, low-risk ways. Mm. You know, like I jumped up on the top of the roof and I jumped off, you know. Yeah, our mind can go into the extremes. And that's what we tend to do, is like the mind says, what about all these extreme things? There's a whole bunch of stuff that's not extreme, that's really obvious, but can have tremendous learning. Thank you for the question. Anyone else? Yes, Kaba. Yes. Sure. So it's around practicing, you know, calmness and tranquility, but noticing there's a shift of going into a level of rigidity around it. And how do you notice that edge? And a lot of it is when life bumps up against you. You know, it's like you can have this intention, okay, I'm feeling really calm here. I just had a great meditation, feeling really connected to nature. And then a dog barks at you, and then that calmness goes out the window, but you're going to try to be calm as you talk to the owner, but you can feel the inner tension, okay? So if we can kind of, again, get out of that way we'd always judging ourselves of how we should be or shouldn't be, to actually notice how we actually are, and to meet that with a quality of compassion and steadiness of attention, that's all that's needed. So something that seems like a failure of the calmness can actually be really insightful. It's like, wow, you know, I said like in the talk that when things are going well, it's easy to be calm, and when things aren't, it's harder. It's very different to actually see that in the moment, in your own experience, because you see it directly for yourself, and how that calmness feels really true, and then suddenly it's shattered. Or you have to kind of tense it up. That's a nice way of saying it. It gets rigid. And okay, what changed there? You know, what belief did I have? So you say, okay, everything's on the table here. What's the self-belief? What am I defending? What am I invested in? You know, what do I bias? My calm is good, agitation's bad. You just put all the cards out and see, okay, what's there? Does that help? Yeah, good. So practice it. Practice it this week. Tell us about it next week. Hmm. Yeah, this is all meant to be practiced. It's all meant to be integrated in our life. Yes, Susan.
You used the word, you didn't say 360, but you said a sense of seeing all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this experience of, I call it's zooming out.
Yes.
And when I've done that recently, and I've seen how these conflicts in relationships that I've had with family have have totally transformed because I zoomed out and I saw like the that I unnecessarily was adding to this, you know, construct of self, and that I was like trying to create something or grasp or attain something that like has totally fallen away. And there's ease, yet there's like, it's kind of like that no man's land. I don't know what's going to happen because something has left.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, so that zooming out, so the comment or question is around, you know, conflicts that when we're in the midst of and really enmeshed in it, especially around family and with all our buttons and whatnot, there's no perspective. But learning to come back to that, you said zooming out, having that sense of a broader perspective, suddenly, you know, you see what that does is it decreases or eliminates the sense of personalization. You start to have a sense of, oh wow, this is how I'm reacting, but it has no bearing on who I am now based on my wisdom and my understanding. And you can start to see things in a more, you start to see the compassion, the suffering that's there in all those interactions instead of being so caught. So it's really this shift from the personalization, this reinforcing what it means about I, me, and mine, to a broader perspective that allows wisdom and compassion to come in. Was there another piece there, Susan?
It was also tied to not a realization of not knowing how to. It's like that I wasn't asking questions in conversations, and I realized I never learned to do that. Ask questions in conversations. It was always like reporting or these people reporting.
Yeah, it's like when you do that zooming out, when you kind of disengage that personal meaning, there's a clarity of seeing, and then there's a freedom of action that arises. You can be much more creative and act in ways that you've never acted, like asking a question that you never learned, you know, that was never part of your repertoire, because you're no longer coming from that personal locus of position. And there's that freedom. I mean, that's the spontaneity that comes as our hearts awaken, that we're able to meet life how it is, free from our past projections or past, all the sankharas, all those things that come into this, shaping this moment. We get clouds away, we see life, that gets cleared away. And we can just see what arises. And the pathway to do that is to just be very attentive of the body. And when those contractions happen, can I meet that with a quality of spaciousness? Sometimes it can feel like I'm going to really go into it, like as feeling it as deeply as I can. Sometimes what's needed, as you said, to be more kind of zooming out, to feel in a broader sense. Yeah, thank you, Susan.
Thank you.